This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Kate Schmid and Hermann Hurling were an unlikely couple in pre-World War II Germany. She was interested in music and literature. He was an aspiring physicist and an expert mountain climber. She was Jewish, and her first husband was killed by the Nazis. He was hailed by the Nazis for his climbing feats while he was staunchly anti-fascist. They met under tragic circumstances, fell in love, convinced the government to let them marry, and then left for the U.S. before the start of the war. Our guest Bettina Hurlin has pieced together their story in her book, Steps of Courage, My Parents' Journey from Nazi Germany to America. She found a suitcase of her parents' letters and did research about Germany in the 1930s to write about their lives. She was the health commissioner of Philadelphia. She taught at Haverford College, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Bettina Hurlin, it's a great pleasure, and congratulations on your book, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, delighted to be here, Marty.
Well, we're very happy to have you here, and I'm thinking about that suitcase that you discovered after your father had died, and I guess, what, sitting in somebody's basement somewhere?
Well, it was after my parents had died, and I was the only child of my parents' marriage. My mother, as you said, had been married before. She had three children from that marriage. But when my half-sisters and I divided up the their possessions after they both had died, my sisters, and I think of them as sisters, essentially said, anything of Papa's, is what we called him, is yours. So there was this little leather suitcase, and leather suitcases, I don't know how many people in the audience have ever carried one, but
they're heavy.
They're heavy. So I assumed it was empty. But at one point when I was trying to clean out the basement, perpetual challenge, I came across this suitcase and I opened it. And this was about 10 years ago. And there were all these wonderful packets of letters tied carefully with a blue ribbon. So I opened one of the blue ribbons, and it was quite clear to me, these letters were written in German, and my German was sort of pathetic, but it was still clear to me that they were love letters. And so what I had in that suitcase was almost 500 letters written between my parents during their courtship. My father was in Stuttgart and my mother was in Munich. And these were letters from 1934 to 1938.
Wow. You had them translated so you could read them.
Oh, no. Please. Okay. I need credit here.
I
actually shut the suitcase. I was terrified because, oh, my gosh, this is huge. And then about 4 years later, the letters called to me. I realized, if I don't translate them, who will? So they were not only written in German, but they were written in this very Gothic form of German, a very complicated form of German called Sütterlin-Deutsch. And so I'm looking at this, and I can't make that out either. And I realize I kind of have to learn two languages in order to translate these letters. So initially I found someone, a wonderful elderly woman, because people don't read that Gothic writing anymore. And she was she had been a voice coach, diction coach at the Curtis Institute of Music for opera singers, diction for German. And so I said, just read me the letters because I can then understand most of that. And she started to do that, and she would stop and say, oh, this is so beautiful.
I realized they're love letters, right?
Yes. I realized this would be indeed a very long process. And I said, you know, Bettina, you really have to learn this. Right. And so I translated the letters.
Well, what's so interesting, and I'm putting myself in your shoes and imagining coming across, you know, love letters that my parents might have written to each other, and the kind of the privacy, the intimacy. I mean, children know a lot about their parents, but there are things they don't know about their parents.
Yeah, and I wondered, you know, whether my parents would have wanted me to read these love letters, because they were very intimate. They were quite steamy and wonderfully passionate. But they had at that point been dead for a number of years, and I thought it was, okay, this is all right. And it was such a journey for me to read those letters and get a sense of their lives and what they had been through. and that made it worth, that was my excuse in terms of delving into these very intimate, X-rated, in some cases, letters.
Well, it tells you that your parents, they loved each other. They were passionate about each other.
You bet.
But that's okay, isn't it? I mean,
oh, I loved it. Yeah. I loved it. Yeah. It was super, because I think we view our parents as many things, but we certainly don't view them as falling madly in love. And
when you get their hands on each other.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, at one point, my father tells my mother, "You have hot blood." And I think, whoa, it was kind of great.
Well, your father, and there are pictures of both of your parents in this book, and they're both a very attractive couple. Your father is very handsome, I should say. He also was an extraordinary mountain climber.
Yeah, he was sort of an Aryan poster boy. He was tall and fair, and he did all the things that Aryan poster boys should do, in terms of he had done first ascents in the Alps, and then in the Himalayas, and in the Andes. So he was really into that extreme mountaineering. In fact, in 1930, he held the world record for having climbed the highest mountain that had ever been climbed to the top. So he was a very serious mountain climber and kind of had the personality of someone like that. He was very determined. He loved solitude. He loved nature. And then he meets this woman, this wild woman, my mother, who is a total flirt and very integral to cultural circles in Munich. And her life was a life of music and literature and intellectual pursuits. It's not that my father wasn't intellectual. He was getting his PhD in physics, which does take a fair amount of intellect, I think, to do. But it was a different kind of world that he was being introduced to.
Well, your book has photographs of some of your father's climbs. And I have to say, of course, this is, you know, before World War II, in the 1930s, in the beginning of the 20th century. And there he is with, looks like, you know, wool pants, a wool jacket,
yes,
a hat,
exactly,
a pickaxe, and what looks like a pretty meager tent.
Yeah, right. Well, a pretty meager tent that weighed, unbelievable. It was wooden pegs. It was made out of canvas. I actually had one of his tents that I have now donated to the German Alpine Club, and will be on display in Munich, because these were really heavy tents. And so they had all this very heavy equipment, hobnail boots. There was none of the high-tech equipment that we have today. So it was called the golden age of mountaineering. It was a very different proposition than mountaineering today.
Well, it's interesting, as you said, and as you write, that he was considered an Aryan poster boy. Obviously, you know, very athletic, very handsome, but he seemed to be, as you have said, staunchly anti-Nazi, anti-fascist.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of that was this mountaineering spirit, where he was independent, and part of it was that he was a scientist, and the Nazi policies made no sense whatsoever on any sort of rational level, this whole idea of the superior race, etc. And he came from a liberal tradition in terms of his own family. But he, when he made these first ascents, he had not planted the German flag on top of these mountains. And that was considered to be unpatriotic. This was even before the Nazi time. And he had planted his regional flag. He did not like the kind of nationalism that was starting to thrive in Germany.
As you mentioned, your mother came from a family that seemed to revel in literature and art, and that seemed to be her interest. She was a flirt as well. As you say, you have three half-siblings, so she was married before she met your father. In fact, her husband was killed.
Yes. Well, she was married first to a man who was a music critic. So that's, in a way, how she got into that into those musical circles. And he was a music critic for the newspaper that was the largest newspaper in Munich, and one of the largest, I think, of the two largest in Germany. So a prominent music critic, and he was a musician himself. And she had grown up in a Jewish household, but when she married him in 1921, she had converted to Catholicism. He was Catholic. And he was killed on, it was on June 30th, just a few days ago, but 1934, by the Nazis. So June 30th, 1934, is known as the Night of the Long Knives, or the Rumputsch, depending on who you're talking to. And the Night of the Long Knives was a very pivotal time in German history, because what happened then is that Hitler wanted to destroy, get rid of the people who he viewed as his final impediment to total power. And he rounded up on June 30th, 1934, over 90 people. There was no trial. There were no arrest warrants. They were summarily killed. And my mother's first husband was killed in Dachau, as a matter of fact.
And why was he picked up? Why was he targeted?
Yeah, exactly. Primarily the people that Hitler rounded up were members of the SA, who were the brown shirts, who were sort of a rowdy division of National Socialism, of the Nazi Party. But he had a few Jews in there, a few left-wingers, a few communists, etc., and my mother's first husband, whose name was Willy Schmid. Willy Schmid, although he's a music critic, was not prominent politically at all. They mixed him up with another Willy Schmid who was prominent politically. So it was a case of mistaken identity. Wow. So he was killed, and the Nazis then said he was killed by accident. And when he was taken away from his home, and we'll see whether we have time to talk about that, but when he was taken away suddenly from his home, my mother for 3 days did not know what had happened to him. And then she got a word from the SS that the coffin would be returned to her, but she must promise not to open it. Really ghastly. And And then she got no apology for a long time from Hitler and his henchmen. But finally, Rudolf Hess, who was a deputy Führer, came to her and apologized to her on behalf of the Führer, on behalf of Hitler. And she describes that in one of the letters, how he bows deeply to her and says that he hopes that she and the children will regard it as a death of a martyr for a great cause. It really makes you want to just sort of say, oh my God, what was he thinking?
Wow.
So.
Well, let's take a short break and we'll continue our conversation talking with Bettina Herlin about her parents. And she's written a book called Steps of Courage, My Parents' Journey from Nazi Germany to America. And it's based in part on letters that she discovered in a suitcase after her parents had died. These were love letters. It also is about, and these letters describe what life was like in Germany before the war in the 1930s when her parents fell in love. They were able to actually convince the government to let them marry and come to the United States. So much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Food waste disposers grind up your food scraps and send them through the sewer system to Philadelphia's wastewater treatment plants, where they're converted into renewable energy and fertilizer. More information at philadelphiastreets.com. InSinkErator supports WHYY.
Whether it's funk or rock, Sly Stone or David Bowie, Van Hunt's music contains multitudes. But he insists that his songwriting is less about combing through the record bins than old-fashioned inspiration.
Most of the songs come to me, you know, when I'm in between sleep and not sleep. They're pretty complete. I can just sit down at the piano. Most of it's right there.
Van Hunt joins us in the studio this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
You might think going vegan, that is giving up eating anything that comes from an animal, is just for people who practice certain religions or foodies with too much time on their hands. But author Anupi Singla says, think again.
Peanut butter and jelly is vegan. So vegan doesn't have to be an outlandish sort of concept.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by Choose PA Wind, an initiative designed to help local businesses and homeowners to understand clean, Pennsylvania-sourced wind energy. More information on using wind energy to power homes and businesses at ChoosePAWind.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Bettina Herlin about a book that she wrote based on some letters that she found, letters that her parents had written to each other before they married. And it's both about a love affair and certainly about a time and a place. The book is called Steps of Courage, My Parents' Journey from Nazi Germany to America. And any questions or comments you might have, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So your mother, the first husband, is murdered, killed by mistake or not, perhaps. And how do your parents then meet?
Well, they met under this cloud of tragedy. First of all, my mother's husband had been killed 2 weeks before she met my father. And the very door that she had opened when her husband was taken away, when there was a knock on the door and the SS was standing out there, 2 weeks later, my father knocked on that same door. She was expecting him, however. And she was expecting him because she was press secretary for a German expedition to Nanga Parbat. And Nanga Parbat is one of the peaks in the Himalayas that's over 8,000 meters high, and no peak over 8,000 meters high had been conquered at that point. So there was a great race as to which country was going to do it. Would it be the English on Everest? Would it be the Italians on K2? Or would it be the Germans on Nanga Parbat? My father had been invited to on this particular expedition. He was feeling it was nationalistic in tone, decided not to go. And Hitler touted this expedition as proof of the superiority of the German race. This was going to be a real showcase to Hitler. And instead, it ended up to be one of the worst mountain climbing disasters ever. Mm. And for sheer protracted agony, there is no parallel in the annals of mountaineering to this day. This were 10 people who died, these long deaths on top of the mountain. And my mother was getting, as press secretary, she was getting telegrams. This person is alive. No, he's not. We heard him calling, trying to get down. There was a huge storm. And she said to the German Alpine Club, she said, send me somebody, please, to help me sort this out, because I am getting so confused by these conflicting telegrams.
And dealing, obviously, with her husband's death.
And dealing with her total grief of her husband's health. Death and yet having to support three children at that point. So the knock on the door was my father, who came, and they had never met before. And I think it must have been a very electric moment, because she opens the door and she's beautiful. And I'm sure he got weak in the knees, which is not what he did when he climbed mountains. But when he saw her, I think he did. And I think she did notice that he was quite handsome.
Yeah.
But here they were meeting under these horrible circumstances. And my father really worked with her then in trying to sort out what was happening with the expedition. And I think slowly she started falling in love with him. Yeah. I think he was in love right away,
but it took her more time. Obviously,
it took
she was
her more
dealing
time.
With
she
her.
Adored her first husband, right. And she writes him saying, how can I be in love with two men? One who is dead, one who is alive. You beckon me into the future, but how can I do this? Was she being disloyal in a way to that relationship? So it took her a while, I think, to come around. And then there was this major impediment, which was that it was a forbidden love in the sense that she was Jewish by background, although she had converted to Catholicism. In Hitler's eyes, she was Jewish, according to the Nuremberg laws, which were the racist laws, and my father was an Aryan.
Yeah.
So there were several things that were difficult to overcome.
there's a section here where, and these were times, I guess, your mother, who sounded like she had some political connections or certainly knew the political elite, that she had to deal with these people. And she writes here, sometimes I myself cannot explain it. A deep inner calm overcomes me at that moment when it's necessary to really fight and assert oneself. She had to deal with members of the party, but she seemed to not revel in it necessarily, but she had courage to deal with them.
She had huge courage. Basically, when there was an admission on the part of the Nazis that her first husband had been killed by mistake, she said, I want reparations. I want reparations from the government. This is not going to just, I'm not going to roll over. So she went and demanded those in front of Nazi officials. And I think of her confronting the Nazi officials at a time when when the anti-Semitism was huge, whether she could have been exposed. She certainly was endangered by doing that, but she wanted to make it right. And she also refused. She had gotten a phone call from Himmler, Heinrich Himmler, who ended up being head of all the concentration camps. I mean, a horrible, horrible man. And he had called her and said, look, I'm going to give you some money over the phone. And she refused that. She said, I will not take money from the party. What I want is money from the government. I'm not going to take money from something that hopefully will change. I want the government, the Third Reich, to give me money. And she fought for that. Mm. And, of course, the two of them, really, the party and the government, were indecipherable after a while. But at that point, there was still hope that people would wake up in Germany and understand how horrible Hitler was.
Both of them also described just the kind of growing terror in Germany.
Yes.
As the government, the Nazi party, begins to not just control the population, but to carry out its heinous crimes.
Exactly. And they saw that. And I don't think everyone realizes how far the tentacles of the Nazi party reached. And they certainly reached into music. All of a sudden, you couldn't play Jewish composers. Jews could not play in orchestras. And she was very involved in that world of music. In physics, you could no longer teach Jewish physics. You could not teach Einstein's theories because he was Jewish, and who would believe a Jew? So it was really it was so endemic in terms of how Nazism poisoned all parts of the social structure, and they experienced that, and certainly in mountaineering, where the Nazis said, oh, Alpine Club, 240,000 members, that's a real plum. We want to take that over. And we're going to insist that no Jews belong to the Alpine Club and that everybody becomes a member of the Nazi Party. My father was on the executive committee of that Alpine Club, and he fought that very hard.
How did their respective parents or families feel about this growing love affair?
Well, she was an illegitimate child of a
complicated family.
Yeah, it's a complicated. There's no question you can ask me that's not complicated in its answer. But her biological father was a Prussian count. And her mother, who was Jewish, had a long-term affair with this Prussian count. So he was dead. Her mother had died 2 weeks after her first husband had died. So in terms of her family, there wasn't that much of a presence. My father's father had died, and his mother very much welcomed my mother into the family fold.
So it wasn't a problem that she was Jewish.
That was not a problem.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Bettina Herlin, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about her parents, how they fell in love, why it was a forbidden love in Germany at the same time, and how they made their way to the United States. Her book is called Steps of Courage, My Parents' Journey from Nazi Germany to America. And again, any questions or comments, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. So how were they able, in Germany, in the 1930s, how were they able to get married?
Well, here were laws prohibiting their marriage. And so it was a formidable barrier to overcome. And it took a lot of years. It took, they meet in 1934, they marry in 1938. And they were aided by someone who I will call a good Nazi. I don't mean a Nazi, a good Nazi in that he paid attention to Nazi dictates, but a good Nazi in that he was a Nazi who was a good person. And he was the personal adjutant to Hitler. He was right up there. He was his assistant. And for whatever reasons, this man had it took pity on my mother. He had seen how her husband had been wrongfully killed. And he also had helped her get through some of the bureaucracy and getting reparations for his death, which she did, and getting his book published, which she did, which was called Unfinished Symphony, of his critical music essays. So his name was Fritz Wiedemann, and he was remarkable in terms of knowing the bureaucracy, getting her through it, and being her advocate. Hmm. So when she went up to Berlin, and she took so many trips up to Berlin and stood in front of these people who were ultimately the planners of the Holocaust and demanded at first reparations, then the book to be published, and then demanded really pushed for her to be able to marry my father. Now, I think they were helped enormously by Fritz Wiedemann, but I think their persistence was quite extraordinary on both of their parts. And I think also the fact that the German government, the Third Reich, was sort of embarrassed by this mistake. They didn't want her to be around. She was very vocal. And she was connected, although she was illegitimately connected, to a powerful noble family in Germany.
So all these were in her favor. But she also sounds like she was a pretty formidable woman.
She
and you're her daughter, so you would know, right?
Yes, yes. She did not take no for an answer. Yes, she was quite amazingly strong.
And we will get to her as your mother, but they were able to come to the United States, I guess, a year or so before the start of the war?
1938. Right. And I really went, one of the things in my research, which was, of course, the letters, but also untapped German archives. But I talked, for example, to the director of research at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, and I said, how unusual was it for, in 1938, late, for someone of Jewish background to marry an Aryan? He said, it really didn't happen. And then I showed him the wedding certificate, which has on the sideline by special permission of the Führer. So it was highly unusual that permission was granted. And I think one of the reasons that they were granted permission is that they would be leaving Germany, and they knew that they would have to leave Germany right after they got married. So they would not, the German race could remain pure because they weren't going to have a baby in Germany. They did have a baby, me.
I was going to say, you were born in the United States.
Yes, yes. And I am not pure, I want you to know.
Well, you're not pure, as many of us are not pure. You also, I think you say this as a young girl, I'm the only real American.
Yes, I would hold that over my siblings, saying when there was a family argument, I would tune in. Of course, I was this little thing compared to them, and I would say, I'm the only real American here.
Just to kind of needle those siblings.
Yes, I needed status. I mean, I had these older sisters and an older brother at that time who has since deceased.
But you also, and this was a difficult time for someone with a German background to be in the United States with the Enemy Aliens Act.
Well, it was really, you know, my parents leave Germany because of Hitler. My father is considered politically unreliable. My mother is unwanted as having Jewish background. And they come here and they think, oh boy, we can relax now in 1938. And then, of course, 1941, the war happens. And then my father is labeled an enemy alien because he is German. The fact that he left because of Hitler has nothing to do with it. And so he loses his job. And it is only through the help of a friend who is very close to Mrs. Roosevelt that he is reinstated into his job. Here he had, at that point, four children.
Wow.
And his assets are all frozen. This was very typical of the time. And he loses his job.
But someone knew Eleanor Roosevelt.
But my mother's best friend from Germany knew Eleanor Roosevelt, a woman named Trude Lash, who's husband Joe Lash wrote all the books on Eleanor and Franklin.
Oh,
so very close to the Roosevelts.
Helps to have connections.
It helps to have connections.
Wow. But your father did help the Allies.
Yes, it was basically once he was reinstated and he had met with different people in the State Department, et cetera, it was made very clear to him that if he really wanted to prove his patriotism, he needed to be of help. And he had no trouble of being of help. He had all these wonderful mountain maps that were used for reconnaissance work then by our forces. He had maps of, there was great climbing around Berchtes Garden, Eagle's Nest, where Hitler, of course, retreated. And he gave those maps. It showed every dam. It showed every village. It showed all of these, every altitude. So he was very happy to do that. On the other hand, these were bombing missions, too, and his mother was still in Germany. So it must have been kind of wrenching, I think, to be doing this. And there were still friends in Germany,
indeed.
But he had no doubt in his mind that Hitler needed to be defeated and as quickly as possible.
Did they talk about their past? I mean, as a child growing up, did you know about your parents' past?
My parents never talked about their past.
No.
And I think they were of a generation. This was before Oprah, right? They were of a generation
right.
where people just did not talk about that past, especially if it was painful. And I think in many ways they wanted to protect their children from that past, mm-hmm. but they also wanted to look to the future. They also said, this is the here and now. This is what we have to deal with. And so part of this finding the letters was a level of understanding I had never had. I knew some of the things. I certainly didn't know all of the things I found in the letters. So it was quite a revelation to me.
After the war was over, did they go back to Germany? Did they go to visit family, friends, and see what had happened to their country?
Yeah, they went back in 1948. Of course, my father's mother was still alive.
There's a picture of her here.
She had been bombed out. Yeah, there's a picture of her looking just, I think, so stricken because she had been bombed out of her home. She had been through hell during the war. So there was a reason for him to go back to see her. To see friends, to see relatives, and they saw their homeland, which they never thought of going back. There were people who came over and said, we'll go back after the war. They never thought of going back. America was their home. They were so grateful to America. They were so grateful for the basic decency of Americans, even though they had ran into some prejudices and problems. Mm-hmm. But they understood America. They got it. And they were never thinking of going back. But they did want to see people who had been near and dear to them.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Bettina Herlin about her book. It's called Steps of Courage, My Parents' Journey from Nazi Germany to America. Again, based on some letters that she found, some research that she did reconstructing their lives, and also a reconstruction of what Germany was like before the war in the 1930s. Taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. On August 3rd, WHYY-TV and PBS stations across the country will be premiering a new documentary produced locally by WHYY. The Barnes Collection tells the story of Dr. Albert C. Barnes and his impressive art collection. Support WHYY's local productions with a $120 donation and we'll thank you by sending you two tickets to visit the Barnes Foundation's new home on the Ben Franklin Parkway. Call 1-888-345-9499 or visit WHYY.org.
Okay, I put my glasses on in that case.
Right, I know.
So I can read it.
See what? Yes, exactly.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at an eventful term of the U.S. Supreme Court with Adam Liptak, who covers the court for the New York Times. Besides the landmark ruling on the Affordable Care Act, there were decisions on immigration policy, juvenile sentencing, campaign finance regulations, and more. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Food waste disposers grind up your food scraps and send them through the sewer system to Philadelphia's wastewater treatment plants, where they're converted into renewable energy and fertilizer. More information at philadelphiastreets.com. Incinerator supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Bettina Herland's parents' love was forbidden in Germany. Her mother was Jewish. Her father was not. But against the odds and at great risk to themselves, they got permission to marry and left for the United States before the start of World War II in 1938. Her parents didn't talk much about their lives before the war when she was growing up, but after they died, she found a suitcase filled with hundreds of their letters tied neatly in bows. She has reconstructed their life and done some research as well for her book called Steps of Courage, My Parents' Journey from Nazi Germany to America. So they come to, I guess, it sounds like New York.
Yes, right? Upstate New York,
upstate
exactly.
New York. And then eventually...
Which, can you imagine how different that is? They come to Binghamton after Munich, et cetera, and they come to this small, lovely, but somewhat provincial town, and my mother reinvents herself there.
indeed, and she seemed very capable of doing that. They end up finally in Los Alamos. Your dad is a physicist.
Right. In 1953, we moved to Los Alamos. I thought it was the worst thing that had ever happened to me.
And how, 53, so how old were you?
I was 13, and I was 14, actually. And I was being taken away from my friends. And I land in this strange community, Los Alamos, which I call the ultimate gated community because everybody had to have a pass to go into it. It was a totally controlled environment, quite sterile. I spoke there recently, and I said all these things, so I don't feel like I can say it to you, too. But in a beautiful, beautiful setting, and of course, it had what Binghamton didn't have. It had mountains, and it had a very lively group of people who at that point were involved in the Cold War and threats of nuclear annihilation. So it was a charged time to be there.
Indeed. Well, I'd love to have you read a section from your book.
Okay. Well, this is when I came east. One of the deals I made with my parents is that I could come east occasionally. So I had come east to New York City. And here's how it reads. When I was 14, I discovered I was Jewish, at least according to traditional 2,000-year-old Jewish laws of matrilineal descent, whereby one's Judaism is determined by one's mother. My grandmother was Jewish, therefore my mother was Jewish, therefore I was Jewish. I was a member of the tribe, even if a straggler. The revelation took place in New York City, where I was visiting my namesake, Bettina. In discussing the difficulties that members of her extended family, the Warburgs, which were prominent bankers, by the way, in Germany, encountered during the Nazi regime, she alluded to those faced by my mother because of her Jewish lineage. I was stunned and more than a little excited to discover a family secret. My mother, Jewish? When I came back home, it didn't take long for me to pop the question, "Mommy, what's this about your being Jewish?" She answered, "Oh, that was in the past." My mother was legendary among her children for being able to cut off a conversation more effectively than a surgeon removing a tumor. Her skill was combined with a kind of grace, or perhaps a coup de grace, that often made you unaware of the cut. If pressed on with questions, she quickly made it clear that you were being totally inappropriate. One sulked off guiltily for crossing an invisible line of demarcation. Try as I did to get beyond, "Oh, that was in the past," I was only successful in making her angry. My affront to her authority and privacy was painful to us both. Later that same day, I cornered my father. Brought up in the Lutheran faith, he never participated in any organized religion as an adult and had not shared in the family routine of attending Catholic Mass. When asked if he knew his wife and my mother was Jewish, He also brushed off the question. He said that coming to America for my parents was about looking forward and not backwards. The rest was indeed in the past.
So it sounds like while it was in the past for them, not in the past for you.
Well, I think that was sort of my first hint that there were a lot of family secrets that I didn't know. And there was a lot I didn't know about my family. And when I heard this, that although I'd been brought up Catholic, that I was Jewish, I thought, oh, this is really exciting. I'm smart. Yay.
Oh, that's what you associate with being Jewish?
Yes, that's what I associate. I still do, actually. But anyway, so that was very exciting for me. But it was, this took place in 1954, and it took me a long time before I really delved more into their background.
Well, but it must be interesting to be a teenager, you know, claiming something from the past, but having parents who were, in a sense, looking forward, as they said, not wanting to acknowledge that past, and obviously a very painful history as well.
Right. Well, I think with our parents, you know, there are all sorts of things that they...
inheritance, right?
Yes, an inheritance that you may or may not want to discuss. You know, why Uncle Sam never comes to family gatherings. You know, whatever it is, I think families do have complexities and they do have secrets, but to understand them is really quite important, I think.
So do you think of yourself as Jewish, whatever that means?
Oh, that's a really complicated question. I certainly... In writing this book, it has certainly awakened a lot, and there's been a lot sort of percolating in me about this. Mm-hmm. And there are so many definitions of what it means to be Jewish and who regards whom as Jewish. It's a bit like walking on the backs of alligators to answer those questions because, you know, if you don't go to synagogue, are you really Jewish? I certainly identify with a lot of the secular aspects of Judaism.
And that feels comfortable and appropriate. And the secular parts are the parts about tradition and perhaps ritual, but maybe not the religion itself.
Well, and values, too, in terms of how you approach life. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's more that than the traditions. It's more the values.
How about, I'm curious, is this something you have talked with your siblings about?
Judaism?
Yes.
Or the book?
Yes, Judaism.
Judaism, yes. My sister is a practicing Catholic. That is a faith that she grew up in, and one sister is someone who is, I don't think I'll ever belong to an organized religion. Mm-hmm. She does not. I think I'm a spiritual person, but she does not belong to any organized religion.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it was painful maybe to reconcile some of these issues about your parents' past.
Well, I think it was painful, but it was also exhilarating to see how brave they were and continued to be and how they really felt it was, they led a very principled life, I think. When my parents came to the United States, 1940, they joined the American Civil Liberties Union. And when in 1954, when my father was at Los Alamos, this was during the McCarthy period, he was questioned about whether he was loyal to this country because he was a member that they talked about three things. One, that he was a member of the American Civil Liberties Union. And they said, I have the transcript of this. Why were you a member of that? And he said, because I came from a country where civil rights were trampled on. And I think it's very important. And he'd also become a friend of the founder of the American Civil Liberties Union, Roger Baldwin. And the other person that they asked him about was Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson had been entertained at our house a few times. And as we all know, was leftist, if not communist, who you're talking to. And they said, you know, why did you entertain him at your house? And they said, well, we entertained him because of his singing, not because of his political views. So he was always very staunch in saying, this is how I want to live my life. This is important to stick to your values, whether they're values you want to pursue in Nazi Germany or during very difficult times in the United States when there was a lot of anti-Semitism and anti-German feelings during when they first immigrated here. And then in Los Alamos, he was really very involved in detecting nuclear testing, high-altitude testing, so that we could have a nuclear testing ban treaty, which was a precursor to the International Disarmament Treaty.
And your mother got involved in the arts.
And my mother got involved in the arts, and she, in many ways, went back full circle. She had been friends with the Budapest String Quartet, which was probably the most famous string quartet at the time, and she got them to play at Los Alamos. There was a very funny headline in Los Alamos, Four Russians Invade the Hill, which Los Alamos was called. She kept up her friendships with Pablo Casals, went to the Casals Festival. Casals at one point said to her, how could a man as kind and nice as your husband be involved in nuclear bombs? And she said, we are lucky to have him there.
Oh,
and
wow.
I think that she was a woman who kept very straight what her values were.
And as a child growing up in that family, did you see that passion that you read about in those letters?
You're talking about the passion between... I knew that they loved each other. I mean, there was always touching. There was always anticipation of somebody coming home. There was always that great, spark between them, which was wonderful.
I was going to say, that's pretty nice.
It's pretty nice.
And did your dad continue to climb mountains?
Well, not the kind of extreme mountaineering that he had done in Germany. And he felt very strongly. He was invited on some other expeditions. But, of course, the war had interfered and interceded in terms of nobody was going on big expeditions during the war. And he basically felt that my mother had lost one husband. And now he had responsibility for four kids, and he was not going to put himself in the path of danger because that's what extreme mountaineering is.
Have you ever climbed, not even extreme, but did the mountains have some allure for you?
Yes, yes.
They do?
Yes, yes. I went to, I mean, in Los Alamos, in New Mexico, I climbed several peaks there with my father, went to school, undergraduate school at University of Boulder, climbed several 14,000 footers in Colorado. So that was something I did inherit and loved.
Yeah, and what fun to mountain climb with one's father, who clearly was a very good climber.
It was great, yes. And he was very clear on how you should climb mountains, too.
There's a proper way.
There's a proper way, yes. Yeah. Yes, you pace yourself, you take minimal supplies, et cetera.
You also did research for this book, as you mentioned, the Holocaust Museum, and I'm assuming archives as well, to kind of not just reconstruct your parents' life, but also to reconstruct this time and place, this very difficult, traumatic, frightening time and place.
Well, I really felt there was an importance here of having their story told, but also interweaving that with historical events, because they were shaped by history. Mm-hmm. They were very much shaped by history. And one thing about the letters I want to mention, I'm going to be donating the letters to the Leo Beck Institute in New York, which is the largest collection of German Jewry in the world, I think. And when I went to meet with them about the letters, they were very excited. And I said, well, you know, the letters aren't everything that happened during that Nazi era, because for one thing, my parents had to be coded about it. These are love letters. They're about hanging laundry out. They're about a kid getting sick, etc. And they said, you know, we know the facts. We know the historical facts. What we don't have for that time enough of is the emotional history.
Yes.
And that's what your letters offer us. So they were very excited about this donation. And I think that interdigitation of a personal story with history really enriches this book. I hope it does, because it really spans profound times. Rise of Nazi Germany, American immigrant experience and then threats of annihilation during the Cold War. So all of that is in there, and the research was done in Germany as well as here.
Yeah. This notion, though, of forbidden love is so profound and so moving in so many ways. And of course, you know, in this country, blacks and whites were forbidden to marry for decades, for centuries even.
Well, in the book, there is an illustration of what it means to be a Jew in Germany under the Nuremberg laws, under the racist laws, which is the most convoluted illustration. The Jews, of course, are black. The Aryans are white. And then the Mischlings, those of mixed blood, are striped. So I'm kind of striped, I guess, in that. You've noticed, right?
I did.
But I showed that illustration to a sociologist, Elijah Anderson, who has done a lot on race in the United States. And we immediately said, is this really like the race laws in the United States about what could be done, what was forbidden? So a lot of analogies there.
And we're almost out of time here. Do you feel like that you understand your parents better?
Yes, absolutely. And I might even add that I understand myself a little better having gone through this process, because it was a personal journey as well as finding out how much they had been through. I had no idea. My father, at one point, the Nazis threatened to make him disappear. When I read that letter, I just started shaking. I found in the archives. So I had no idea.
Well, Bettina Herlin, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Marty. It's been a great pleasure being here.
Well, you're very welcome. And the book is called Steps of Courage, My Parents' Journey from Nazi Germany to America. And if you want to check it out, you can go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Fox Books here in Philadelphia, and the Penn Center Bookstore as well. And our guest actually was health commissioner for Philadelphia a number of years ago.
Yeah, and I taught 17 years at Penn.
years at Penn on top of that. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, with Jonathan Best this week. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.